Trib Live is made possible by AT&T, NRG, Christus Health, and BP.
Please join me in welcoming Tom Banning, Ann Dunkelberg, and the Honorable John Zerwas.
Thank you.
Welcome, panelists. Appreciate you being here. Let me begin by asking whether we have a crisis. I know that people disagree about what's going on in the world of healthcare, but I want to establish the parameters of the discussion by asking if we have a crisis. And if we have a crisis, what kind of crisis it is? Is it a crisis of cost, or is it a crisis of care, or is it a crisis of both? Yesterday, the Texas Public Policy Foundation, along with Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst and the chair of the Public Health Committee, Representative Kolkhorst, had a press conference at which, among other things, they talked about the need for reform and observed that by 2014 or 2015, if we don't do anything about it, the cost of Medicaid would eat up half of the budget. At the same time, last week, the Texas on the Brink report came out from the Democratic Legislative Study Group that pointed out things like, we are first in the percentage of population uninsured, first in the percentage of non-elderly population uninsured, 50th in per capita spending on mental health, 49th on per capita spending on Medicaid, we're 44th in health expenditures per capita, and on and on. So we have an array of statistics on the care side, but we also have great concerns expressed about cost. Ms. Dunkelberg, do we have a crisis of care or a crisis of cost or no crisis at all, and all this is overblown?
I probably would never have chosen the word crisis myself, and I think that my gut reaction to that is partly because healthcare is so massive, that it's like that slow-moving ship that can't be turned overnight, and so it's hard to think in terms of crisis when you have something that simply can't change quickly. But no, I definitely think we are lacking both on the care and cost control side, and it's not a state issue. This is totally a national issue that in the United States we are spending more than any other industrialized nation as a proportion of our gross national product on healthcare, but we have less to show for it. And in the case of Texas, we have some of the worst statistics in the country.
So. Dr. Zerwas, you and Ms. Dunkelberg may not agree on everything all the time, but this may be an area of agreement. You also think that there's a crisis of some sort?
Well, I agree with Ann. I question whether we should characterize it as a crisis. If it is such a crisis, then we've had this going on for quite a long time. We have the greatest health care in the world. There is no doubt about that. It's manifest in many, many ways. But we have a health care system that leaves many, many people in a lurch and unable to access the greatest health care in the world. And the question comes to us is that as we now see to some extent that is potentiated by a fiscal crisis that we have, some would describe it as that, there is some greater amount of urgency that we need to address in a very fundamental way some of the things that are not addressing the healthcare needs of what I consider the greatest state in the nation.
But without a fiscal crisis in Texas, without a budget shortfall of $27 billion or $16 billion or any billion, we would still have an issue at the federal level with healthcare, would we not?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, if we look back over the past two biennia where, in fact, at least the state of Texas had a substantial amount of money. In fact, we had even a little extra money to do other things with. Right. We still have a system, however it has evolved, and we all have our take on that, that still leaves a lot of people with an inability to access the greatest healthcare in the world. Right. My personal opinion is that it has largely been driven by the skyrocketing cost of healthcare, of which there are some very fundamental issues that have driven that cost. I think that's really what we're trying to do. I think that's what the President's Health Care Reform Act was trying to do, was to basically remedy some of this skyrocketing cost by putting a lot of people into the insured category.
Right.
And I admire that, but I don't agree that that's the primary driver of the skyrocketing cost of healthcare.
You're okay with the idea, but disagree with the way you did it.
Well, wait a minute. I'm not sure that's how I want to characterize Devin.
Well, because I heard was a very respectful description of what the president was trying to do. I thought we should just end the event right now, actually. It was extraordinarily civil of you. So
I agree that that the magnitude of the uninsured and the access of the uninsured to health care is a contributor to the skyrocketing cost of health care. But I don't think that it's the primary or the sole thing that you try to remedy in our healthcare system in an effort to rein in the cost of healthcare. And I think that's the big challenge that we have ahead of us.
Now, Mr. Banning, you represent a lot of healthcare providers, doctors and folks in the medical profession. When you look at who is responsible for whatever the situation is, crisis or not, who do you look to? What's your take on this? And what do your members say?
I think if you look at a historical perspective, we have had a problem with how we, and Dr. Zerwas hit on it, how we deliver healthcare in this country and how we finance it. Going back to 65 when we passed Medicare, to 74 when Nixon tried to solve the healthcare problems, in the 80s when Reagan went through it, in 94 when the Clintons went through it. And it's a matter of the non-system that we have.
What do you mean by non-system?
Well, we've got, you know, you look around the world, and every industrialized country has got some sort of foundation that is based on primary care, where they try to do keep people from getting sick. Frankly, and our incentives in this system are misaligned, where we pay for treatments, very good, important treatments, after people become sick. And I would agree with Dr. Zerwas that we do have the best healthcare system in the world for what I would call sick care or rescue care.
This sounds like Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst's plan.
Well, and I don't think that anyone would disagree that we need to move our system back to something that aligns outcomes and value with the dollars, which is not how our non-system operates today.
So what I'm alluding to, of course, is that last week Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst talked about how we don't have a health care system, we have a sick care system, mm-hmm. and he is part of a group pushing legislation that would incentivize providers to do more preventative work, do more work on the front end to prevent the costs on the back end. And it sounds to me, Mr. Banning, like maybe you and your members feel that's a good plan.
That's absolutely correct. And back to your original question, everybody is responsible for the cost of care. Physicians, hospitals, drug makers, device makers, patients, everybody's responsible for it, because an old physician told me one of the things that stuck with me from when I started. He said, people want three things, and they can only have two. They can have any combination of the two, but they can only have two, and that's they want the best, they want it now, and they want it cheap.
And can't have all three.
That doesn't work.
Right. Do you all agree with Mr. Banning that the blame is the wrong word, but that the responsibility for the cost skyrocketing does cut across every category? Patients, hospitals, insurers, doctors. Would you agree? Nobody is exempt from that.
No.
Representative Zerwas, your colleague, Representative Coleman, is going to Washington this week to plead what he believes is a case not only on behalf of his side, but on behalf of Texas to the federal Medicaid officials. He told Emily Ramshaw of the Tribune staff this week that he's going basically seeking two things. He wants to see the enhanced FMAP funding, which is the percentage of Medicaid funding covered by the federal government. He wants that expanded beyond June. As I understand it, the enhanced FMAP funding runs out in June. It has been enhanced because of the dire economic situation with stimulus money. He believes that if we get the federal government to extend the enhanced FMAP money, that it might save Texas $2.5 billion in the first year, a total of $5 billion in the second year. Do you support the idea of enhanced FMAP money being one of the goals that Texas should be pressing?
I do, but perhaps not for exactly the same reason. I think that, one, the way the formula for the FMAP is calculated, it penalizes Texas for, one, it the wealth that the state enjoys. Our per capita income is better than most across the country.
Right.
That is a basic part of the element of the formula that drives the FMAP calculation. It does not take into consideration the poverty burden that the state bears. And so one of the things that came out of House Bill 479 when we looked at what would be the repercussions of opting out of the Medicaid program was a discovery that, you know, here we do carry 10% of the poverty burden of the country, but we only get 7% of the money that's dedicated to the FMAP. And if we got a more equitable formula in that regard, then we would basically be pretty comfortable with where we are in terms of the funding for the delivery of healthcare services.
So in principle, extending the FMAP funding, you're not opposed to, but you just want to see the formula changed.
Yeah, I think you really need to get down to a more fundamental reason as to why the formula doesn't work in Texas, and it's because it doesn't recognize the poverty burden that we carry.
Right.
Extension of the FMAP could have some huge repercussions to the state of Texas in a positive way in terms of meeting some of these needs out there. And there are states that are in much more dire need of that than we are. And so I think there's probably a whole national effort trying to say, look, can we extend the FMAP for another couple of years until we can kind of pull ourselves out of this economic recession that we're in?
Now, Representative Coleman, there are some hospital folks here today in the audience who I know are interested in this part of it. As I understand it, Representative Coleman is seeking to square the question of managed care with this so-called upper payment limit. This is where the difference between Medicaid and the maximum allowable reimbursement, I guess, for Medicare. How do we pay the difference? He would like to see that UPL and the statewide managed care situation fixed so that it's okay for us to do that. And I wonder if you view that with an audience of hospital people, what do you say about that?
Well, I say that UPL is critically important to the survival of our safety net hospitals. And it has done great things to allow these organizations to not only stay in the black, but also to plow that money back into resources to deliver health care to those that are in need of the safety net. And so I think it's very important. There is a little bit of a trick around this plowing, carving
hospital
care into managed
out,
care.
Right, yeah.
Right now it's carved out and so that you can account those days for UPL calculation. The trick comes in is as we expand managed Medicaid and carve in health hospital services into managed care, there are savings for the state to be realized in there. But that is only going to happen to the extent that we can preserve UPL. It's a very, very important priority for us as we look at various things that we're considering doing in the appropriation.
So you and Representative Colbin are not that far apart, actually, on the principal issues that he's bringing to Washington to press with the Obama administration.
Representative Colbin and I are on the same page on a lot of things. There's a few things that we are on either ends of the bookshelf. But
but
on most things related to health care policy, Representative Coleman and I are absolutely on the same page.
Now, Ms. Dunkelberg, the group of conservatives assembled yesterday at this press conference are really pressing for a different set of things, but in some respects, more flexibility for the federal government is what both sides want. In their case, they're asking, as I understand it, for an ability to curb enrollment benefits and actually to work on eligibility, maybe limit eligibility to get control of this situation. What's wrong with giving Texas more flexibility? Isn't this an era in which Texas asserts and demands and should receive more flexibility from the federal government?
Well, in my line of work, you're always a little skeptical whenever the word flexibility comes up. And you just say, stop, let's talk specifics. You know, when you say flexibility, you haven't told me enough. So what we really need to figure out is what it is that people want to spend less money on in the Texas Medicaid program. And when we get down into those details, you know, some things may turn out that we agree on and other things we won't. I think one of the key proposals that was laid out yesterday was the notion of moving from guaranteeing some minimum standard of comprehensive care to Medicaid recipients to just a defined contribution financially that might or might not actually meet their health care needs. And
you don't like that kind of flexibility?
Well, I think that one of the most important things about the Affordable Care Act, which is a goal that is separate and apart from cost containment. It can only be achieved with cost containment, but all the cost containment in the world will not get you to a system where you have guaranteed a comprehensive, decent standard of care for every American, or at least every legally present American, regardless of what their income is, so that you've adjusted the cost to fit their income. And there's a huge philosophical divide between the notion that we should just give people whatever care X percent of their income will buy, or whether we should guarantee a minimum standard of decent care. And I think that's where we come apart.
Do you dispute the fact, though, that we're in a situation where with the administration attempting to grow, not reduce, the number of people who are eligible, that we don't have an option but to do something on the cost side? And what the folks who showed up at the press conference yesterday, spoke at the press conference, are saying is, look, we're not looking to limit eligibility because we're mean. We're looking to limit it because we just think we don't have the money to pay for everything that we're promising people.
Well, I think I have to be a little skeptical about that in the current...
The meanness part?
No, the we don't have enough money part.
Ms. Wolgamuth is right there. You can just say it directly to her.
Yeah. Okay, where were we, Evan?
Well, you were saying how you don't necessarily think that that I mean I was asking if you believe that the cost problem is intractable, which is really what they're saying. We have to deal with it, and this is the way to deal with it.
Healthcare spending in the United States is intractable. And I think the fallacy is that the actual research shows that Medicaid spending is not growing faster than private insurance spending, and that both of those sectors are growing more slowly than Medicare spending.
Right.
And the only reason we have this special different attitude towards Medicaid is because our state legislature has to pay for part of Medicaid, and they don't have to pay for Medicare or for the runaway costs in the private health insurance sector, except to a lesser extent through employee benefits and the like. Our country, I think perhaps without realizing it, we wish that if we could just crack down on Medicaid enough and get those poor people to stop costing so much, that none of the rest of us would have to change anything about how we deliver care or how we consume care. And I think the truth of the matter is we should be looking at, and frankly, part of the discussion this session is looking at the kinds of reforms that are going to have to go across the entire healthcare system.
Right.
Yours, mine, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Everybody's.
We should not be looking to folks on Medicaid to, certainly we may not be giving them the Cadillac of healthcare, and most of us will never experience the Cadillac of healthcare.
Right.
But we should not be expecting there to be special solutions or doing things to that program that we would not do for all Americans.
Now, another part of this is folks on the conservative side are also asking for funding that comes from the federal government that tends to be more of a block grant. So that rather than actually telling us, here's money and you have to do these things, just basically drop a bag of money at the state line and say, you all go figure out how you want to spend it. Folks in your view of the world don't like particularly block grants. I know that Representative Coleman is on record opposing the notion of block grants. What do you think about that?
I think there's the actual track record of Congress with block grants has been that they have not kept them up with anything remotely related to population or inflation. And so if you look to any of our existing block grants, you would not want them to be the model for the funding stream that you're going to have to pay for 70% of your people in nursing homes and half your births and everyone with a permanent disability or chronic mental health. So our existing block grant model is not a good one. That's not to say that things don't have to change about how we finance healthcare. And I think the gold standard is to bring inflation and healthcare spending down to something much closer to the rate of general inflation instead of 2.5 times it, which it is now. But it's also, as Tom said, to change from a system that just has sort of uncontrolled market forces working in it to one where the financial incentives align with our actual clinical and health outcome incentives.
Now, Mr. Benning, to Ms. Dungleberg's point, you know, there are things that can be done across the board. But I want to come back to this question of flexibility. You know, I have to believe that the people who you represent, doctors and other medical professionals, would love to have fewer strings attached,
sure.
Would love to have more of an ability to provide care the way that they see fit, to tailor care for their patients, for their community, and not have to take orders from the home office. So where do you come down on this dispute between these two sides?
I think one of the most critically important things that gets lost in this debate is that in 1986 or 1987, Ronald Reagan signed EMTALA, which guarantees universal access to healthcare, regardless of ability to pay or immigration status. So anybody who walks into a hospital, the hospital, by federal law, is mandated to care for them in an emergent situation. The discussion is not about how we deliver care as much as it is how we finance it, because the hospitals are subsidizing it, and the non-system that we have doesn't provide a medical home for these patients with Medicaid, Medicare, insurance, or not. In terms of flexibility, you know, let's have the discussion because it's all around cost and we need to have that discussion. The concern that I would have in terms of flexibility is, you know, let's say that we determine that something that we're covering now is not needed or that we're just not going to cover it anymore. Does that mean that the need goes away for that patient? No. It just means that patient is now going to go to the emergency room to get the care that they need for that service because we're not paying for it. So, you know, flexibility is in the eye of the beholder. You know, we're almost an entirely managed care state. When managed care companies come up with their actuarially sound premium, they assume how much utilization is going to be provided in terms of these services. So, you know, they've got the flexibility that they need. Now, if you want to start pushing cost off to Medicaid enrollees like the private market's done, that's fine, I guess. But, you know, are they going to have the financial wherewithal to absorb those costs? And, you know, if you look at what's happening in the private market, it's not. I mean, my company's got a health savings account. Last year, we required our employees to pay $2,500 out of pocket before insurance kicked in. We increased that amount to $3,000 this year. Our insurer, that starts with a B, last year increased our premiums 21%, even though we had a medical loss ratio of 51%. This year, they increased it 24%. You know, that is a problem if I've already said to my employees, $2,500 out of pocket, $3,000 out of pocket, and my insurance
and then they get
is still...
hit, and then they get hit again.
That's right. And my insurance that I'm paying for them is still going up 46% over two years.
You dispute, Dr. Zerwas, that insurance, to the degree that Mr. Banning is talking about it in his own case, is a problem, that the cost of insurance is going up?
Well, I think that's just a fact, that it is. I mean, all we got to do is look at the various numbers out there that are published and so forth. But
What do you do about that?
Well, I do think that there are a few things that have to happen in terms of reining in the cost of health care, which typically is reflected in the price of health insurance. And I think one of those things is that I do think that you still have to have skin in the game. And I think that although your experience, Tom, doesn't reflect it, I do think that HSAs are something similar to that, where people have some accountability and some discretionary ability to buy various health care services, works. And there are examples of that out there of large companies who have converted to that. And perhaps it's the critical a number of people that you get involved in these before you start to see that cost curve bend. And so I think that's an important element that the healthcare industry has largely been insulated from, because of the way health insurance has always typically picked up every first nickel that has gone into somebody's healthcare. And so we haven't used the open market in order to do that. The other thing that I think is an overarching thing that we don't have right now, but you have in some unique parts of healthcare, is payment for quality and the competitive forces that arise out of that. And the places that I typically talk about it, where you have seen quality and competition come into play to drive down the cost of healthcare, is typically in your LASIK surgery for vision correction. It's not paid for insurance. It's out there in the open market. The lasers get better and better. The results get better and better. And the price comes down, and there's more ways for people to get it financed.
And we're motivated to look for quality because it's coming into our pockets.
Well, exactly. And I think that's something that, for some reason, that has been taboo in the healthcare market, at least as it has evolved in the way that we pay for healthcare. And so I think that's just one place where I sort of take a difference of opinion with Tom on that, is I think that if you look at larger companies or larger institutions have incorporated HSAs, and at a point when they get to a critical mass, you start to see the inflation and that cost of healthcare for that company go down substantially.
Mr. Banning. Yeah, I don't disagree with that, but when you look at the healthcare marketplace, 50.4% of insured lives are covered by Medicare, Medicaid, CHIP, TRICARE, or some other government plan. In terms of large employers that have HSAs, yeah, it works great for them because the large employer is self-insured and they're putting, you know, their own money into the insurance system. They're putting their own employees into that market. The problem arises within the individual and small group market, which is where our organization is. And there is a utter lack of oversight of the insurers. They can game the system any way they want in terms of premium increases, about what's covered, what's not. And the system that we have around large self-insured employers completely skews the marketplace in terms of individuals and small businesses being able to compete for insurance business in those markets. And, you know, there was a bill that that did not get debated federally. It was the Bennett-Wyden bill that would have essentially forbid or stripped away employer-sponsored insurance and required everybody to buy some level of insurance coverage, which would have change the dynamics of how we provide health insurance. It'd be like right now if Dell provided car insurance for all of their employees. You know, their ability to have 15,000 lives compared to my 12 lives, you know, the insurers are going to come and run to Dell for that business, which, again, is a problem within the market that we're dealing with today.
Let me, as we time moves along here, Dr. Zerwas, go back to the president's health care reform, which we alluded to earlier. Let's leave the politics of it out of it for the moment. I mean, a lot of people argue about how he did it, how the Democrats did it was not the right way to do it. Let's talk about the substance of it today. What do you like about it? What don't you like about it?
Well, what I like about it is that there are things in it that try to promote the idea of quality and actually getting healthcare organizations, physicians, and otherwise really focusing on quality and the delivery of care and recognizing that quality and so forth. You know, what I clearly don't like about it is that what it is going to do is explode the Medicaid population. That is going to be a burden to the state that we are not going to be able to sustain, frankly. And so I think that has
not in this state, not in any state.
Exactly. And we've heard that over and over. And you can argue about what the number is over a 10-year period of time, but it is a lot of money. And it is a lot of money that's going to come out of other places like education and public safety and infrastructure and so forth in order to keep up with what is going to be a massive entitlement. So that is what I have a huge problem with. And I don't think that that is going to contribute to reigning in the skyrocketing cost of care.
You're also unhappy with the individual mandate, the so-called individual mandate, which at least as of now by this judge in Florida, this court in Florida, has been declared unconstitutional. You're not happy with the individual mandate component of that either.
Right. I'm not at all. And again, I understand that is something. In order to get what they want out of this bill,
right,
you have to have that in there.
Yeah.
But I just think that philosophically, I'm opposed to that being imposed on us as a citizen of this country.
Ms. Dunkelberg, you smile when I mention the individual mandate being unconstitutional.
Well, I smile because, as you know, there have been four federal judges
who
ruled. There
have been four different, it's two and two, right?
Two have held
right.
it up and two have struck
We're
it
We're all
down.
Captives of the
and
last conversation,
it's not
though,
a matter
right?
of scoring on this. The Supreme Court will decide,
yeah,
so,
right.
and probably not until 2012.
Are you optimistic about the Supreme Court finding this to be constitutional?
I don't think I have standing to... Right. to make a judgment about that. I think the one thing we all have to know is that we won't know until they decide, and that probably won't be till 2012.
You disagree with Dr. Zerwas about the notion that one of the big problems of the Obama health care reform is that it explodes the number of people who are in the Medicaid system and therefore explodes the cost to us and the burden on us?
I'll be bold enough to say that, but I will, and I'm sure you're all shocked, but I'm gonna step back and say the reasons that what I do like about the law, when I have gone out and done like 40 training sessions around the state, and I must say, we refuse to do these unless people will give us 90 minutes. So it's really hard to encapsulate anything.
Yeah.
But one of the things I say is, everything about this new law is flawed. Congress is not capable of passing laws that aren't flawed. That's the way our system works because there were a million compromises involved. But this is the first time our country has ever tried to establish a system where at least everyone lawfully present has a guaranteed access to a decent standard of care no matter what their income is.
Right.
It's a major change in the way the insurance market works to where you can no longer be profitable by avoiding risk. You have to be profitable by managing risk and attracting customer service. And the Medicaid, the individual mandate piece, to the best of my understanding, is basically something the insurance industry wanted, because if they're going to move to a model where they can turn no one down and can't charge anyone more based on their healthcare status or history, then they want all the healthy people in the pool too, or else the pool will be unavoidable. So nobody put an individual mandate in there because they thought it was the right thing to do. It was just a practical
Well, in fact,
matter.
One criticism of the Obama healthcare reform bill from the left
mm-hmm.
was that it basically was like an economic development
For the health insurance,
for the
industry.
Health insurance
yes.
industry.
If you look
right?
at the projections for the Affordable Care Act, the vast majority of Americans, the number of Americans continuing to get their coverage through employer-sponsored coverage from
right.
commercial insurers is almost unchanged. You're just adding a Medicaid expansion and you're adding a new exchange where private coverage and public subsidies come together. But on the Medicaid end, I think that you'd be crazy to suggest that there are not significant costs to the state budget. Even the Health and Human Services Commission's projection for the 10-year scoring period of the bill, not the 10 years from 2014 to 2023, but the 10-year scoring period of the bill that all of the CBO scores are based on, the latest HHSC numbers in their report on your analysis were that in that period, they thought the state costs would be somewhere under $6 billion. And they did not mention, but the controller's report, Controller Collins' report, mentions that 70-odd billion federal dollars will come into the state at the same time to match those state dollars. Right. So we're in a sort of perverse situation where the great news is we're finally changing Texas from being a donor state that sends way more to Washington than we get back.
To a donee
state. The bad
state,
news
yeah,
is right. We have to pay our 5%. You know, we're right. at 5% in 2017. We pay nothing until 2017.
So when Commissioner Sees says that, contrary to what the CBO claims, that it's going to cost us about $1.5 billion the cost of Texas will be $1.5 billion of implementing this. In fact, it'll be $27 billion, I think, was the last number that Commissioner Sees said.
From 2014 to
2020. That is not a rounding error. Right, that's not a margin of error deal. There's a huge difference between what the CBO folks are saying and what Commissioner Sees is saying. So what are we to make of that?
I think that, and I've said this in my educational session, this is largely a political difference. I mean, in the report—
Is math political? I thought math was objective.
Well, I think the model that was used to come up with the $27 billion figure includes a whole lot of assumptions about federal funding going away entirely for something, the state taking on certain expenditures that it has that have nothing to do with the actual cost of the Medicaid program. Right. Also, HHSC assumed that 94% of eligible people will enroll in Medicaid, which is, you know, 10 to 15% higher than anything we've ever achieved in Texas, even for kids.
So you think they're basically taking a worst case view?
It is absolutely a worst case view, and I think they will tell you that, and it may even be their job to do that, to say this is the absolute worst that could happen, so we should prepare. I agree that CBO's estimates were too low. There are some very good estimates out there from Kaiser and the Urban Institute
that are
in the middle.
Yeah. Mr.
Ben. Yeah, I was just going to say that a lot of the assumptions were made around rates, keeping physician rates at Medicare parity beyond 2014 and DSH moving away. I do want to mention one thing about the federal ACA, and I told my staff when I accepted this that I'm probably going to upset some people when I talk, but when you look at the underpinnings of what's in the ACA, it models what was in the 1994 Republican Health Care Act that they put forth against Hillary Care. It had 19 Republican sponsors and 2 Democratic sponsors, and it included an individual mandate. It included pre-existing condition clause. It included subsidies for individuals. So a lot of the things that are in the ACA were, frankly, brought forth by the 94 Republican right. Congress.
In fact, Dr. Zerwas, Representative Coleman says, President Bush put into effect in 2003 enhanced FMAP funding. President Bush denied a waiver to Texas in 2008. Much of what's being proposed in the Obamacare, what's so-called Obamacare stuff, was in fact previously pushed by Republicans. He says the difference is now it's President Obama, and that this is entirely about President Obama and not about the substance of this. What do you say?
No, I don't think that's the case. I think that some of the things that were done in the past to try to provide the care, it's okay to give subsidies, but let them go buy let them go buy it out there on the private market. Mm-hmm. It's okay to recognize at some federal poverty level people need help. Now, what a shame it is that our healthcare insurance market is such that at 400% of FPL, you have to get a subsidy to go buy health insurance. Now, That's a problem with the healthcare market, that we have to look at it at that magnitude. And we need to remedy that. But we don't need to continue to foster it by giving subsidy payments to people at 400% of federal poverty level. I find that what we're doing is we're just feeding the beast, and the beast is going to continue to grow. And so I don't think that's a good way to do it. But I do think there are things that we can do with people at various income levels that for whatever reason we've decided that they shouldn't have to do these things. That we should protect them from the open market and some of the competitive things that go on out there. These people, frankly, are probably very, very good about stretching their dollars, and they probably know it a lot better than a lot of folks out there. And so I think that we need to get away from the idea that that subsidies or having people go out there in the private market to purchase health insurance is something that's bad. You know, I don't agree with that at all.
We have time maybe for two questions before we open it up to the audience. I want to ask about, we talked about Obamacare. We alluded to what's now being referred to as Dewhurst Care, which is the which I'm sure the lieutenant, I'll get, be getting a note from the lieutenant governor about referring to it that way. But I want to ask about Zerwas Care. You actually ruffled some feathers by saying, look, we have to accept the fact that while we may not like what is coming out of Washington, there's a likelihood that we're going to have to deal with it. And we're better off dealing with it on the front end than having to deal with it on the back end. And so you've actually introduced some kind of a health exchange program as legislation, anticipating that some, if not all, of the Obama Health Care Reform Act is going to find its way to Texas. Can you talk about why you did that?
Exactly. We spent the interim taking a lot of testimony to be sure that we understood what was in the Health Care Reform Act and what were the things that we needed to do to prepare the state of Texas to best be able to manage it. A lot of these things could be handled through the regulatory functions of TDI and HHSC. So they were things that didn't really require any particular legislative action per se. What we came away with, though, was clearly the we needed to get an exchange in place, and that if we didn't do it, we cede that exchange or that management to the federal government. It was our opinion that is not what we want to have happen to the state of Texas. And so we developed a bill. We looked at a lot of different models out there. We looked at various models that were not healthcare related within the state of Texas to come up with an initial run at this and to get it out there early in the legislative session so people had the opportunity to look at it, chew on it, consider what its merits are, what are the negative things about it. There are a lot of political issues that come into bear on this, some of it being that an exchange is synonymous with healthcare reform or Obamacare. And right. From a political point of view, that's kind of the thing I have to deal with.
You have the votes?
I think we'll have the votes, yes. I think the question is that once it gets through both chambers and to the governor, will it get through the governor in order to put it into place? An exchange is just something that operationalizes some things that happen in the healthcare market. In and of itself, it's not the thing that makes a big difference. But if you were to look at a block grant and to bring a lot of money into the state of Texas and you were going to try to funnel that into different places to help people get health insurance, you would want an exchange in place. And exchanges have been around long before they were ever associated with the Health Care Reform Act. And so they have a value. They're largely an operational entity that is put in place in order to help make something happen in an area. And another thing we brought up recently, we talked about, look, you have a New York Stock Exchange because you go out there to buy stocks. It makes it easier to do and so forth. You have cattle exchanges to buy and sell cattle out there. And so the concept of an exchange is not new. In fact, it's really not even new to healthcare. It's just that it has taken a very highlighted role in a Health Care Reform Act that there is a lot of polarization around. And so it's become somewhat synonymous with that. If we don't do it, though, and this has been my primary motivation, is that we cede it to the federal government. And I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat, I don't think you're going to want to cede the health insurance market of the state of Texas to the federal government, which will probably do a one-size-fits-all, which we don't think is going to work for our state. Or any state for that matter.
Mr. Banning, yeah. And quickly. And then
yeah, I was just going to point out that it's important to remember that Dewhurst filed Senate Bill 7 and 8 in 2009 before the federal ACA was even written. I think Massachusetts and Utah filed exchange bills or passed exchange bills in 2005 and 2007. So, you know, I think you could make the argument that the feds took some good ideas from the state and put them into the ACA.
As opposed to, right. Before we open it up, we haven't really talked about the state piece of all this. We have a budget shortfall again. Pessimists say 27, optimists say 16. Truth is probably somewhere in the middle. And healthcare is a significant portion of the part that we can cut. And so the assumption is that healthcare is going to get cut pretty dramatically in the state, and the question is not whether, but what do we do about it specifically. The Tribune and the University of Texas did a poll recently, the results of which came out this week, that showed, while on the one hand, voters absolutely want budget cuts, the three things that they want cut least are nursing home care funding, children's health insurance, and funding for Medicaid providers. In fact, overwhelmingly, more than even border security. They were more prepared to cut border security, which is the great sacred cow of this legislative session. They would rather cut border security than cut funding for those programs. Dr. Zerwas, what do we do about that, then Ms. Dunkelberg, and then Mr. Bann?
Well, I think that we're in the process of taking a lot of testimony and trying to understand where people are and what are the consequences of certain cuts that may be in place or proposed right now, and then where do we end up at the end of this. Probably the number one concern I have about the cuts that are proposed in place related to Health and Human Services are what's going to happen to the safety net of the provider network out there. And at 10%, on top of all the other cuts, we're going to see, I believe we're going to see the safety net fracture. The consequences of that happening at this day and time are enormous.
It's not avoidable, though, right? You're going to see these areas, not only the areas that I mentioned, but other areas of healthcare funding in the state have to be cut because the math doesn't work out for them not to be cut.
Correct. Now, I'm not saying it's no cuts, but I do think at the level of cuts that are at least initially being proposed here, we compromise the delivery of care, the nursing homes, all the care, the full continuum of care starts to get compromised.
And you think we can't do that?
I don't think we can do that at that level, and I think we have to come up with alternative ways to soften that.
Ms. Dunkelberg, everybody in the education realm and the higher ed realm and in the healthcare realm is saying, well, I know that the cuts proposed for us are enormous, but we're going to rein those back in and push it off on the other areas. There aren't enough areas to push all those non-cuts off on.
Yeah, I wasn't aware anybody had the nerve to say that. I think our observation...
Well, it's math, isn't it?
Here's some math. The Legislative Budget Board says that the Foundation School program is $9.x billion short. The Legislative Budget Board, which always has the lower estimates, not the higher ones that the agencies has, says that their budgets on the House and Senate side are $7.6 billion short on full funding of Medicaid. So right there, you're over $16 billion.
Yeah.
So much for your optimistic estimate, because there's cuts in the rest of the budget too. And I think, you know, you do have to have be a little bit of an expert to look across all those numbers and figure out whether the cuts are evenly distributed. And they're not 100% evenly distributed, but basically everything that the state of Texas does is looking at being cut back by about 25% if we don't add some revenue to this equation. And so while I think there's actually some positive opportunities here to really aggressively embark on some delivery and service reforms in our healthcare programs that are hard to do because they're just like your doctor said, you know, everybody wants three things and you can't have them all. Well, people want cost control and flexibility, but you know, unless you're going to let doctors do things that don't work, somebody has to be able to tell doctors you can't do things that don't work. So it is hard to pursue some of those practice reforms. We will pursue those. There's a good opportunity to do that, but the amount of money that we can save by implementing every best practice in the world, short of just defunding programs and shutting down the safety net, isn't going to deal with a gap the size of $7.6 billion.
Right.
So we have to be talking about looking at the Rainy Day Fund and raising some new revenues, even if they're temporary and sunsetted revenues.
Are we talking about the Rainy Day Fund being used, at least in part?
Oh, absolutely.
You're for that 100%?
Not completely.
Not 100% of the Rainy Day Fund.
Not 100% of it, but
you're 100% for using part of the Rainy Day Fund.
Absolutely.
Unambivalent.
And I would say, you know, and this is just, you know, conversations I've had with many people, is that we got a hole to fill for this biennium, about $4.3 billion. I think that ought to come out of the Rainy Day Fund. And I think that at least certainly what I pledged to by preserving the Rainy Day Fund last session was that the balance of that, not all of it, but perhaps leave $1 billion left in there in order to continue to build on that for future. But that can leave you $4 to $5 billion, depending on where you are at the end of the biennium on this, to use to soften. Now, as Ann says, that's still a long way away from meeting what we are the critical needs. But you can dull the edge of this budget a little bit.
So you're saying, Representative Zerwas, that you would not only take 4.3 out to buy down the previous biennium's shortfall, but you would also go above that and buy down some of the current biennium shortfall.
The current biennium shortfall, $4.3 billion. Absolutely.
Yes.
I think you look to the Rainy Day Fund right now.
You said you would almost take the Rainy Day Fund down to $1 billion. You might spend $7 or $8 billion out of the Rainy Day Fund.
Absolutely, and I think that largely a number of reasons. One, I think that if my district is reflective of most out there, they think it's raining, and they think this money ought to be used in order to help us deal with the budget challenges that we have. Not only for the shortfall we have now, but going into the future. I think that's critically important. If I go home with a budget that has a sharp edge on it like this one does, with $5 billion in the bank, I'm going to take a spanking for that. I will guarantee you. So.
All right. Well, we'll come back to your spanking in the Q&A portion, I suspect. Mr. Banning, very quickly, which of the what areas of the healthcare cuts would your folks be willing to endure?
You know, I think it's important to remember that we've got universal health care. We're just not paying for it, or we're not financing it appropriately. And if you cut in one area, those costs are going to manifest themselves in other places,
right,
in the emergency room and criminal justice. So I don't know the answer to it. I mean, then there's not a simple one. Obviously, it's an entitlement. You know, they could lowball the projections in terms of caseload growth and cost growth and push it off to the next biennium. You know, we've been doing that for the last 15, 20 years as a way to score the or balance the budget. I am sure that there will be some legislation that we can score some savings in that may or may not, you know, come true. But it'll help balance the budget. And, you know, again, Medicaid's an entitlement, so we're going to have to pay the piper at some point.
All right, well, I'm having to pay the piper now because we've run long, for which I apologize. We've had a great conversation with John Zerwas, Ann Dunkelberg, and Tom Banning. Let's give them a hand, please, for their candor. Thank you. And we will use the, we might go a tiny bit long on Q&A. We have about 5 minutes. Maybe we can go to 7 minutes. I know we need, Ms. Dunkelberg needs to go. Are you okay? Well, let us open up for questions. We have a number of very smart, smarter than me, people on healthcare in the audience who probably have better questions than I will. And we're going to use this mic to pass around. We have a gentleman in the front right there first.
You. Who are we pointing at?
Right there, hand up, a white shirt, right there in front of you. Look right straight ahead, right there in front of you, see?
Oh, sorry.
It's okay. Sir, go ahead.
I have a pre-existing health condition, and I haven't... The new law would help me, and I haven't heard much from the other side that would help me. So, what would you propose as an alternative to the ban on pre-existing conditions exclusions that would help me?
Dr. Zerwas, what about that? That is one aspect of the current bill that many more people seem to agree on than disagree.
Right. I think that most people would say that some of those provisions that were incorporated and made effective in September of this past year, most people would say, yeah, those are good things. And as a society, we feel that people should have access, whether you have pre-existing condition or not. The bottom line is that that's going to cause the cost of health care insurance to go up. And we all recognize that. So if that's what we're going to do, don't try to say that it wasn't something that didn't contribute to the increasing cost of health care. It does, you know. And to a large extent, that was because out there in the market, that was an avoidance measure in order to make sure that you managed your risk appropriately. If the law says now that we're going to take all folks on with any pre-existing condition, then let's just accept the fact that there's going to be an increased cost associated with that.
But let me just follow up on that question's point. So is there an alternative scenario that would get more people with pre-existing conditions insured that would not be the current? Is there any way to do it at all without increasing costs, the way that we were talking about?
Well, the idea, I think,
do you have as an alternative if you don't like this?
And I'm not saying I don't like that. I'm just saying that this is the consequence of doing that, you know. And so, there are alternatives. There are high-risk pools. There are other things out there that are extremely expensive. But if you're going to mandate it and then spread it out across the entire population, the cost is going to go up, but it's not going to be as painful as it would otherwise for an individual trying to seek it in a high-risk pool.
Professor Henson's hand I saw was up there, and then Ms. Richards in front.
Quickly, one of the things that we also saw in the polling that the Tribune is rolling out that we did the UT Trip poll this week was that as people are look at budget cutting in the abstract, they're very much reluctant to talk about new revenue, very, you know, seemingly willing to cut. The more they're confronted with specific cuts in the way that Evan discussed, we seem to see an erosion of that willingness in a kind of, you know, more consideration of new revenue. That seems to be going on in the public as they hear about cuts in healthcare, cuts in their schools especially. Do you think that same dynamic is going to happen in the legislature?
Let me ask Dr. Zerwas, and then maybe ask the other panelists if they want to jump in. Is revenue back on the table now as people confront the magnitude of the cuts?
I think people are certainly searching for alternative sources of revenue. I think that the line is drawn in the sand around sales tax increases. But things that I think people are talking about is, why is the margins tax not performing as it was estimated to perform? Let's look at that. Are there loopholes that need to be corrected? Those aren't new taxes. Those are simply, you know, looking at a provision that was made that didn't perform the way that it was supposed to perform.
Well, Chairman Pitts, you're chairman on the Appropriations Committee. In fact, on this very stage about 6 weeks ago, said that he believed closing loopholes on the margins tax was a tax increase.
Well, I guess I'm not sure I agree with the chairman on that, you know, but I do think that that we would be looking at that regardless. And we have been looking at it. Why did the margins tax not perform to the degree that we thought it should? We've looked at what are those things that should happen to make that. Now, if we're going to monkey around with the margins tax and do something that actually is an increase in taxes, then that's there's something that jeopardizes that position.
You like gambling?
Well, I'm not a gambler personally, but you know, gambling is, I think we as a state just need to have that debate and dialogue. And then ultimately what I do support is taking that as a public referendum and let people in the privacy of a voting booth decide whether we want gambling in this state or not.
Either of our other panelists want to weigh in on revenue taxes, whatever?
You know, I think the to your point about the polling and public perception, as strange as this sounds, the ACA debate was the easy part. You know, they expanded insurance. It wasn't done in a great way, but they avoided the cost question. And when you look at demographic trends about the baby boomers that are about to double the size of Medicare and the expansion of Medicaid, you know, the costs are unsustainable. And how we balance that cost question about what we provide and how much we pay for it, you know, that polling data, I think, was dead on in terms of how they're diametrically opposed to answering that very complex question.
One thing to keep in mind about the revenue situation is that job loss is job loss. And so, you know, it's been estimated that there'd be a direct 100,000 job loss at, you know, at the current public education cut, that about 60,000.
Yeah,
60,000 of those would be teachers. There's a multiplier effect from that. We're already seeing layoffs at state agencies. And so, I think there are legitimate economic questions about, you know, if you take cuts too deeply, does it really cripple your recovery? Does it really, you know, is that contributing more to slowing Texas recovery than modest across the board revenue increases would do? But I also think that that's only going to happen, and it's only reasonable to expect it to happen, if people let their legislators know that they have weighed that choice and they think that that's supposed to happen. I think I have to remind people when I go out and do public education that if all they do is vote, they really haven't given their elected official much information about what they want, and they're going to have to get a little more specific. So,
Ms. Richards?
One comment, one question. Judge Kessler in the District of Columbia this morning upheld the constitutionality of the Obama health care.
So now we're at 3-2.
My question is, I'm particularly concerned about the attack on women's reproductive health care in Texas currently. And I would like each
well,
of you to...
Well, this will take 1 second to answer.
I'm sure it will. But I'd like your comments.
Dr. Sirwas,
I'm very concerned.
You want to weigh into that one?
Well, you know, there are provisions for women's health care in the appropriations budget. We are looking at those things. And from the standpoint that we're looking at them and so forth, we're looking at trying to preserve women's health care in any number of venues and areas out there and stuff. So at this point, at least in the area that I'm deeply involved in, I don't think from a financial point of view, you're going to see us attacking that necessarily. But there will be, you know, the weight that has to be borne by all parts of the appropriations budget, as we talked about. But I do think that there are things that if we do them, they start to, again, fracture the safety net out there, and we just have to consider what the consequences are.
So are you referring to possibly the defunding of Planned Parenthood affiliates that don't only provide abortions but also provide health care services for women in some areas where an abortion is not even on the table? That's one thing that I believe the Attorney General's ruling of last week gave the HHSC essentially greater latitude to enforce what is already on the books, which would allow them to defund from the women's health program, funding from affiliates of abortion providers.
Right. I think we have to look, and everybody knows, no secret, I'm a very pro-life individual, you know, and I'm not at all sympathetic to abortions except under very unique circumstances. But there are a lot of good healthcare services that are provided in some of these other venues. I mean, very, very valuable healthcare services. And I think we just need to be sure that we don't lose the ability to deliver those quality services that are out there. I am not somebody who wants to see us promote or be connected with necessarily abortions that would be done under certain circumstances, you know, but where, you know, you have a need for something, you know, where typical ones, incest, rape, threatens the health of the mother, very, very unusual, unique circumstances. Most people would agree that that's a reasonable thing that we should look at, you know, but I don't think that we should, I think we should try to disconnect those things and say, look, let's look at some of the very valuable women's health services that are provided, which I will tell you far outweigh the incidence and number of abortions that are performed in connection with these institutions.
Tanya, can I do one quick one? We got to cut it off. Okay, well, I apologize. We went a little bit long on the conversation, a little shorter on the questions, but I thought it was a great morning and a very valuable time. Let's again, please give our guests a hand.
Thank you. TribLive is made possible by AT&T, NRG, Christus Health, and BP.